get dickheads in any society.
I never said that I thought it would be bad.
Are you high now?
Yeah.
Hello, Tom Tilley with you for Hack. One of the big decisions you'll make is whether or not to go to uni. And then if you are going to go to uni, where do you go? Is it about the vibe on campus or prestige?
From high school, I always knew that both Melbourne and Monash were the top unis.
And so that was a big factor in your decision, like the prestige?
Yeah, definitely.
In just a moment, get a guide on how to make that difficult decision.
Hack on Triple J.
I just went out and started Googling short-term loan. It wasn't until I really started to get the notices saying your money's due or don't forget your pay's coming up that I really started to panic and realise what it is that I'd actually gotten myself into. It's really a matter of three quick clicks.
Hack. Triple J.
If you needed cash fast, how would you get it? Okay, except for asking your parents, where would you go? Well, there are such things as payday loans, and you'd be surprised how quickly they get the money to you, like really quickly. As Caitlin's story highlights, these loans end up costing you way more than you realise, and women appear to be more susceptible to them than men. So we're going to find out why, and we're also going to ask the Minister for Financial Services what's being done to stop these dangerous loan practices. First, Lucy Sweeney brings us Caitlin's story. Let's find out how badly she got screwed over.
I had applied for a credit card with a bank. At the time, I applied for a credit card of $3,000, and when it arrived, it was for $10,000. So when that happened, I was very excited, thought that it was probably the best thing that's happened to me. Didn't really stop to think about the fact that I probably could not afford to be making repayments on a $10,000 credit card.
Meet Caitlin. She's 25 and she's more than $8,000 in debt because of decisions she made 4 years ago.
Went away and was very stupid and spent that money very quickly and got to the stage where I then had to start repaying the credit card and found that I fell behind my repayments.
To try and catch up, Caitlin took out what's called a payday loan. That's basically a loan for less than $2,000 that you have between 16 days and a year to pay back. Usually they're repaid by a direct debit from your bank account or a deduction from your pay.
I just went out and started Googling short-term loan, short amounts of money or small amounts of money before payday, and Nimble was one that popped up. I remember looking at it and I decided, no, I don't want to do this because I didn't quite understand how it worked. And then over the next couple of days, I noticed that Nimble was really everywhere I went. So if I was on Facebook, it would be in my news feed. I'd be sitting on my work computer and would come up as an ad on Google or on a website that I'd be looking at. And eventually I went back to Nimble and then went ahead and got the short loan with them.
Caitlin applied for a $600 loan to be paid off over a month. All she had to do was answer a few simple questions online and the cash was approved within a few minutes.
To be honest, I was actually really excited when I received it because the language was, Caitlin, you've been approved for up to $600, and there's lots of exclamation marks, which I thought was just really exciting at the time, and they really sucked me in there. Only a few minutes after that, you can see another email I received from them that said, good news, exclamation mark again, lots of exclamation marks in their emails, saying you're now eligible for $800 on your next Nimble loan. So, and I have a few more of those where they're telling me that I can now start applying for more money than what I originally did.
$600 doesn't sound like too much, but stay with me here. The terms and conditions that Caitlin had agreed to included a 20% loan establishment fee and a 4% monthly interest fee, which is all standard for the industry and totally legit. But now, all of a sudden, that $600 loan is a $744 loan, and she couldn't make the first payment, half of her loan, due in 2 weeks.
It wasn't until I really started to get the notices saying your money's due or don't forget your pay's coming up that I really started to panic and realise what it is that I'd actually gotten myself into. They gave me 5 days. Otherwise, you'll be charged a $35 late fee. And I couldn't pay it, so I was charged the late fee. And then my debt obviously started to increase from there, and I still wasn't able to meet the payments, so that by April, so about 4 months after I got the loan, my loan had increased from being $600 to $1,100 because of the late fees and the penalties I faced.
Fast forward to today, and Caitlin's still paying back both the Nimble loan and her credit card debt.
So you might be paying off $50 a fortnight to cover the loan, but that only really covers the interest that you're paying, which is why I think I've been paying it for so long.
What our new research has found is that vulnerable women are the fastest growing segment of the payday lending industry.
Caitlin's story is one Adam Mooney has heard many times before. He's the CEO of Good Shepherd Microfinance, a not-for-profit that offers financial counselling and short-term loans with minimal interest.
This is an industry that is really a lender of last resort that provides very expensive, extortionate, in many cases, entangling finance for people on low incomes that have no other option.
They commissioned their own research into payday lending earlier this year.
What it found is that over the last 10 years, that the number of women, particularly young women, accessing payday loans and having significant economic problems as a result has grown from 84,000 10 years ago to 177,000 today.
That's a 110% increase. The Good Shepherd Report found one of the most common reasons women found themselves turning to payday loans was chronic overspending, causing financial stress. In the past year, payday lenders have been subject to a whole lot of scrutiny over the way that they operate. The government ordered a review into the sector last year and recommended some changes to the current laws, like reducing the amount payday lenders are actually allowed to offer people in the first place. But it didn't adopt all of the suggestions put forward during consultations.
Women in particular are often taking out multiple loans at the same time. So you might have three, four, five loans, and we've called on the federal government, we've called on regulators to put in place a database that can at least monitor and make sure that people are responsibly borrowing and only taking out one loan at a time.
But the government said no. Good Shepherd also wants to slow down the payday loans process.
So we think the 2 to 3 to 4 hours for what are often either adrenaline-fuelled or in some case substance-influenced or infused lending decisions that are made that are not in the best interest of the person. So we think that a pause between the loan approval and the drawdown is a very responsible way to go.
One thing that caught me with Nimble and probably with some of the other websites as well is the fact that it's just so simple and quick that you don't even realise what it is that you've done. It's really a matter of 3 quick clicks.
Hack on Triple J.
Caitlin's story, a cautionary financial tale there. A lot of people texting in on that one on 0439757555. One person says, I don't understand how people can be so financially vacant. I'd love to hear from you. Have you had a problem with a short-term loan? Give us a call, 1300 055 36. Corey, did that story resonate for you?
Yeah, it did. Like, I heard that she was 25 and she's only got this small amount of debt. Like, it seems big to everyone else. When I was 18, I got offered my first credit card by a bank, was silly enough to take it, and then a couple months later, got offered the shadow limits. They were silly enough to take it and give it to me, and now I'm 23, and I've got 40 grand worth of debt.
Whoa. Oh, that's horrible. And I guess, yeah, the combination of the credit card and then these other short-term loans can be really problematic. Did that happen for you? Did you try and take out other loans to try and deal with the credit card? How did it unravel?
No, well, what it was is I tried to go with rival banks to try and give me a credit card to buy out other credit cards.
Yep.
But then just got hit with all the interests and all the fees.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what happened to me. Started to fall behind on one, used it, borrowed from Peter to pay Paul, and just kept picking myself a bigger hole.
Yeah, totally. All right, thanks for the call, Corey. Hope you can find a good way to pay down that debt and get back on your feet.
No worries. Cheers, thanks.
All right, let's find out what the government's doing to protect people like Corey and Caitlin from dangerous short-term loans. We've got Kelly O'Dwyer with us. She's the Minister for Financial Services, and she was actually given recommendations from an independent review into small amount credit contract laws. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Tom.
What concerns do you have about the practices around short-term and small credit loans?
Well, look, we were very concerned that some very vulnerable people were being trapped into paying off their debts by getting into even more debt. And I think Caitlin's story is a very good example of that. So what we did is we initiated an independent expert review to look at not only small amount credit contracts and the very, very high percentages that were charged for very, very small loans, in some cases up to 350% on a $500 loan.
Wow.
Which is really extraordinary. We actually also decided that it was important to look at consumer leases as well, where people are actually leasing out goods and paying extortionate amounts to do that. So we've had some recommendations come in from the expert panel. We have been consulting with industry. We then had the election in between that, and we're now looking at whether or not there ought to be some caps for consumer leases as well as for small amount credit contracts. So we're very close to finalising it.
Okay, yeah. Well, you got the review in March. So when do you think you'll actually decide which of the recommendations you'll introduce?
Well, I think the recommendations are very, very sensible. And the government will be in a position, certainly before the end of the year, not only to respond, but to look at the implementation of a lot of these recommendations. One of the particular concerns that we have is in relation to people who are in an even more vulnerable position than Caitlin, people who are being paid by the government, who might have Centrelink payments and are using those payments to actually pay interest on some of these small credit contracts.
Yeah, and I saw that one of the recommendations was that only 10% of their income would be allowed to pay off these short-term loans.
That's right, so that people aren't finding themselves in a position where they're getting into multiple loan arrangements and not having the ability to actually pay it off. We're also considering a recommendation as to whether or not that cap ought to apply across the board.
Okay, the other interesting thing about Caitlin's story was that she actually, I guess, even got one of these loans in the first place. For her, it was over 4 years ago when she got into that kind of trouble. In 2013, a law was actually introduced to stop loans of less than 16 days. So does that mean Caitlin's situation shouldn't be able to happen anymore to anyone?
Yeah, that's right. So small amount credit contracts for loans of up to $2,000 where the term of the contract is less than 16 days was actually made illegal from the 1st of March 2013.
Right, okay. And is that being enforced or are suppliers finding ways around that?
Well, it's illegal, so it is being enforced.
Yeah, right, okay. Now, one of the practices that seems really dodgy is quoting of monthly interest rates. So in Caitlin's case, she was quoted a 4% per month interest rate, but when you actually do the math, that's the equivalent of an annual rate of 48%, which is completely off the charts. Are you considering a law that makes it illegal to quote a monthly interest rate?
Well, we're obviously considering how information is disclosed, and I think the point you make, Tom, is a very good one, which is that people need to be very careful that all of these rates compound and they increase the amount of debt if you're not actually paying back some of the balance but are only paying some of the interest. So it means that you're getting further and further into debt.
Well, someone's made a point about education. Someone says, is it not lack of education that people spend too much or sign up for these dodgy loans? And not everyone understands the concept of compound interest.
And this is where ASIC have got a really good toolkit, the ASIC Money Smart website, where people can actually plug in their details and actually see the impact of some of their financial decisions to actually educate themselves before they make these sorts of decisions.
Yeah, Anton from Sydney's made a point about this as well. He says, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Maybe legislation should be tight, but people need to take some responsibility for their actions. There's no such thing as a free lunch. I mean, how much of a role do you think government should play and how much of it should we, I guess, be responsible for ourselves?
Yeah, well, look, there's no question that people who borrow money need to understand that at some stage they're actually going to have to pay it back. You don't get to borrow money and not have to pay it back. But at the same time, we do know that there are situations where people are extremely vulnerable and they are certainly taken advantage of. And we want to make sure that for those people that there are adequate protections in place. But your point, Tom, is right, and the point of your listener is absolutely right, to say that people do need to take on some responsibility for the financial decisions that they do make. And it's not a smart idea to be paying off debt by creating more debt.
Absolutely. You're listening to Kelly O'Dwyer, who is the Minister for Financial Services. And we've been talking payday loans or dangerous short-term loans. And we'll get back to your stories in just a moment. But quickly, Kelly O'Dwyer, I want to ask you about some of the other big political stories of the day, because tomorrow the new Parliament goes back. Are you excited?
Very excited, always, Tom. I'm sure all of your listeners are equally excited about it.
Cannot wait to hear how question time goes down for the first time.
Tomorrow we've got lots of procedural motions tomorrow with the new speaker,
right.
And then we go across to the Senate, and then we go back, and the Governor General gives a speech. So tomorrow is pretty ceremonial, but Wednesday is the day where, if you're interested in question time, that all of the action will take place.
Okay, one issue getting a lot of attention is the same-sex marriage plebiscite, and Labor and the Greens oppose the idea of a people's vote. And today we've found out that the Senate power broker, Nick Xenophon, said he won't vote for it either, which begs the question whether or not the plebiscite can actually get through Parliament. And we actually put that question to Nick Xenophon today.
Does this spell the end of the plebiscite? Is it dead in the water now?
Well, unless the government can find other numbers for it, whether it's the opposition or any other parties, it seems to be the case. If the opposition and the Greens hold to their positions, I expect they will, that's it. But that doesn't mean that the debate isn't over. This is an important issue. This is an issue that ought to be determined by the Parliament. We can do this.
So the plebiscite could get pushed back a long way. Sounds like it's going to play out perfectly for the Conservatives in your party.
Well, look, I think it's no secret that obviously I've got a very strong view on same-sex marriage. You know, I'm a strong proponent of change to the Marriage Act, and, you know, I would like to see that happen as soon as possible. But we did take a commitment to the last election, and that commitment was to allow everybody in Australia to have their say on this particular issue. Now, we're going to honour that commitment because it's important. We put our hand on our heart and we said we were going to do it, and now we need to actually do that. And I think it is really quite extraordinary that the Labor Party and the Greens and Nick Xenophon are saying that the people of Australia can't be trusted to have their say on this very important issue. I certainly trust the people of Australia to have a very civilised debate. I think that the vast bulk of Australians will agree with my position, which is to change the Marriage Act. And the more that we delay this decision, the less likely that we will be able to actually bring forward legislation to change the Marriage Act.
All right, well, I guess we'll see how civilised the debate is in Parliament before it gets to the public. Kelly O'Dwyer, great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Tom.
That's Kelly O'Dwyer, who's the Minister for Financial Services, and we are talking about dangerous short-term loans. Melissa, you've called in. You think it is all about education.
Yeah, definitely. I actually think these kinds of life skills should be taught at school.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and I guess they are to a certain extent. It's just whether they're, I guess, we get enough information in schools, given there's so much else we have to learn about. Thanks so much for calling in. Let's find out how you can cut through the crap and spot a bad loan a mile away, and also why women seem to get caught up in payday loans more often than men. Catherine Robson is a financial advisor at Affinity Private in Melbourne, and she hosts a podcast about female leaders. It's called Success Stories. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us. In your experience, I mean, we just heard in that story about women getting caught up in these loans more. Why do you think that is? And is that your observation?
There's a couple of things that feed into that. Firstly, women across the economy tend to get paid less than men. I think also women find themselves in part-time work, casual work more often than men, and therefore find themselves in financial difficulty. I think also women tend to put the needs of others ahead of their own, and so often they will find that they'll be the ones paying for the essentials like childcare and looking after older parents and prioritising the needs of others and find themselves left short at the end of the day.
Lots of people have been writing in saying it's all about education and financial literacy. And for example, earlier I highlighted the fact that a 4% monthly interest rate is actually 48%. How hard is it to get across the basics? And I mean, what are the key things you think we need to know about so that we can spot a bad loan?
I would echo Kelly O'Dwyer's comments that the ASIC Money Smart website is a fantastic resource, and it's a resource you can rely on because it's not distributing or promoting any products. I think also some of the big superannuation funds are doing a terrific job of providing member education, and in some instances actually providing education that's free. And Vic Super, for example, here in Victoria, offers a free education program for women called Superwoman Money. And that allows both members and non-members to go through a 5-week money education course. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to take responsibility for our own life skills, and being financially literate is, I think, an adult skill that all of us should have.
I think so. Catherine, great to speak to you. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
That's Catherine Robson from Affinity Private. Joel, you actually used to work in the industry. What sort of practices did you see go down?
Lots. There's so many different tactics that so many different competitors would use. And when you look at the places that they were positioned, all these places were put into socio-demographic areas where it was a low-income, mid- to low-income earning area. I mean, Caboolture, off the top of my head, in Brisbane, has six.
So, right. Did it feel unethical working in that industry?
Sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. I mean, sometimes you got contractors that honestly just didn't get paid on time and they would come in for a loan. And we used to offer a two-week interest-free period. But then some people would take advantage of that and it becomes a revolving door for a lot of people.
Yeah, it must be hard to, I guess, stand behind the counter and watch that. Are you still working in that industry?
No, I got out of it. It can be heartbreaking at times. Like, we had this one woman continually coming in and you would see the same stuff come through and she was using the same excuses every time. But, you know, you try and feel bad at the same time, but then they sort of do put themselves in that situation knowing what they're getting into.
Yeah, totally. All right, thanks so much for phoning in with your experience from the other side of the desk there, Joel.
No worries, man.
On the text line, I've learned from my parents to never get a credit card as they've been in debt for the last 20 years.
They're shooting. Just leave and run. It's not worth it.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
There was a major drama at LA Airport today. Panicked passengers rushed to evacuate after there were reports of gunshots. But the Los Angeles police have said that the whole thing was a false alarm that was caused by some loud noises. And it all wrapped up a couple of hours ago and there's heaps of delays, but the terminal has reopened. But not before police detained a man dressed as Zorro, complete with black cape, mask and a sword. So no word what Zorro's involvement was, but it does seem like security was a bit lax given they have a Zorro tolerance policy.
If it's ranked high or low, I don't really mind.
I guess that was one of the things I looked at was, I guess, the university's ranking one of the best universities in the world.
Hack. Triple J.
Sorry about that bad pun there. Gave it a shot. You are listening to Hack. And when you're leaving school, deciding whether to go to uni or not is a big decision. It can be hard enough just to answer whether you want to go or not. But if the answer is yes, the other question is, which uni should you go to? You know, is it all about the vibe and the party life on campus? Is it about academic prestige or graduate salaries when you leave? The Good Universities Guide can be a lot of help to work out all of those criterion. And it actually came out today. So let's find out which unis are scoring well and what else you need to think about when you're deciding which campus you should grace with your presence. Our reporter Jo Lauder graced a few Melbourne unis with her presence today.
I heard that the social work program there was really good and a lot of unis don't offer undergrad social work programs.
Yeah, the location's really good.
From high school I always knew that both Melbourne and Monash were the top unis.
And so that was a big factor in your decision, like the prestige of those unis?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that was one of the things I looked at was the university's ranking one of the best universities in the world.
When you're looking at where to study a particular course and one university to go to, a lot of people turn to the Good Universities Guide, and its latest edition is out today and answers some of these questions. It ranks universities in 13 different categories that matter to potential students. In each category, Australia's 39 universities are scored between 1 star and 5 stars. In the graduate salary section, that is how much people will earn after finishing at that university, the University of New England, the University of Southern Queensland and Charles Sturt University all scored 5 stars. But these universities have a lot of mature age and off-campus students.
I guess the reason why I just chose to go there is because a heavy part of it is to do industry-based learning. And so I guess that helps when I find a job, which is really hard.
If it's ranked high or low, I don't really mind.
Looking at the 5 key measures the Good Universities Guide rated for a good student experience, Wollongong University, Bond University and Edith Cowan University all got a clean sweep of 5 stars for student experience. It's handy information for people making what can be a tough decision, but the Good Universities Guide does have its critics.
The universities criticise the methodology, then do everything they can to maximise their rank.
That's Andrew Norton, the Program Director for Higher Education at the Grattan Institute. He says the Good Universities Guide's star rating system can be unfairly misleading.
The way they do this is simply divide the universities into 5, and so if you're in the top 20%, you get 5 stars. And if you're in the bottom 20%, you get 1 star. So what it means is that because, you know, by definition, there have to be 7 or 8 universities that are in the worst category, they are put with 1 star. But in absolute terms, their performance might not be much worse than universities that get 4 or 5 stars.
One thing the Good Universities Guide doesn't have is an overall ranking. And universities obsess over rankings. For that, you need to look at tables like the Times Higher Education Rankings and the QS. In both of them, the University of Melbourne comes in as the first Australian university. But Andrew Norton says these rankings don't mean that much for new students.
If you look at most of the international rankings, they're all heavily driven by research, sometimes entirely driven by research. And all the studies done in Australia and other countries show that research quality does not predict teaching quality. So if you're after an undergraduate course, the fact that a university is in the top 100 in the world, that's not particularly useful information.
For example, in the Academic Ranking of World Universities, which is a highly regarded one, 30% of universities' score is based on how many Nobel Prize winners are at that institution.
They will never see any of those Nobel Prize winners, so it's not going to benefit their education.
Hack. Triple J.
Joe Lauder reporting, and I'd love to hear from you. How did you decide which university to go to? Did you care about the tables or the Good University Guide? Was it all about location? Was it about college or campus life? Love to hear from you. Give me a text, 0439 757555. One person says, I chose to go to Macquarie Uni in Sydney just because of the green vibe of the campus. No regrets. Mitchell. Someone else says, hey, Tom, I was set on going to Melbourne Uni, took a gap year and got into a better course at a regional uni. Small class sizes, excellent lecturers. And it was only after I accepted that I realised the course was really well renowned, winning all round. So glad I didn't choose the big unis in Sydney or Melbourne. That's from Kelly. Well, let's go to Ross White, who actually works for the Good Universities Guide. Ross, thanks so much for joining us. Looking at the results from today's Good Universities Guide, it seems like you kind of have to choose either good campus life or a good graduate salary and employment outcomes. Why is it that few unis can actually offer both?
Yeah, hi Tom, thanks for having me. That's an interesting point, I think. The thing that really struck us about our results this year in the Good Universities Guide is that this data is really, really rich and it's really complex. There's a lot more to things like graduate employment outcomes and graduate starting salaries than meets the eye in a simple number. So case in point here, we found that some of the best earning graduates or universities that are producing some of the best earning graduates are characterised by specific student cohorts, specific kinds of students. So typically we see a lot of non-traditional students, so students who study maybe part-time or students who study off-campus or mature age students. They typically are the ones who are really well employed and or some of the best earners. So if you think about that in terms of the context of on-campus experience, a lot of these students may also be students who don't spend a lot of time on campus. Mm. So, yeah, there's a lot to it.
Yeah, I noticed that at my uni, Macquarie University, there's so many people coming in at night that you sort of wondered how much that was taking away from that traditional university vibe where you imagine everyone hanging around, you know, all day long, supposedly bludging, but actually people are working really hard and often working full-time jobs at the same time. There's so much to consider. Like even in your results, there's 13 of the main criteria you rank the universities on. I had a complex situation where I chose a certain course at a certain university and then I ranked all the unis from the, you know, the hardest to get into, the easiest, and basically chose that all within Sydney. Sure. And when I got to uni, I realised I could have maybe gone to a higher ranked university if I'd chosen an easier course to get into and then just changed after a year of good results. It gets very complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it really depends on what's important to you and what you want to achieve with your university studies as well. It's a big investment, both in terms of time and financial resources for prospective students. So what we... Our philosophy behind presenting content in the Good Universities Guide is really to go with the fact that students primarily are looking for a course at a university. So we present all of our information at a specific field of study level and compare institutions' performance on things like graduate employment rates and student experience at a field of study level. And we really encourage our readers to drill down and start with the field of study. So think about what it is that you want to study. Think about how your chosen institution is stacking up on that particular field of study. Then step back and think about the overall institutional results.
All right, Chris, did you use the Universities Guide?
I took a look at it. I can't say it definitely influenced my decision a hell of a lot. I guess I was pretty typical when I finished Year 12, and I wasn't really sure exactly what I wanted to be, but I knew kind of what area I was interested in studying. But it turned out not to be for me. So I actually ended up going to four different universities, and even within one of those universities, I was at three or four different campuses.
Right, okay. So eventually, what was the main criteria that you think should have been the most important to you?
It's about teacher engagement. And since then, I've actually taught at uni too. And it's so much about who your lecturers are and whether your tutors give you the time of day.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because a lot of people look at the broader reputation of the teaching quality at a university. So it is so hard to tell. Christy, thanks so much for the call. And Ross, thanks so much for joining us in the studio.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Cheers.
Hope that was some help for you if you are deciding which university to go to next year or any time in the future. A lot of people texting in about my bad pun on the Zorro tolerance policy at LAX Airport. At least you gave it a stab, Tilly, says one person.